Hey friends, welcome back to the Semi-Seminarian. First of all, I just want to say thanks for the patience. Last week it was finals week over at the seminary, and so we weren't able to upload last week, but we're back this week with another installment of our Bible for Grown-Up series in which we are examining the book of Job. Tonight, we're going to look at a character by the name of Zophar. Zophar is going to be somebody you probably, if you've been around church experience, or it may not even be in a church. If you've been in any type of group of people, you probably experienced this kind of person before. The know-it-all. The one who knows everything and is convinced everything that they know is right. And if you disagree with them, that's all the more proof that you're wrong and they're right. They're called dogmatics. And they are crazy when it comes to interpersonal relationships. Zophar is just like this. We're going to see another conversation here tonight between somebody trying to talk to Job about God instead of talking to God. I hope that you'll enjoy it. We'll see you on the other side. Okay, buddies, I'm going to go ahead and get started. It's 6 o'clock. And just to kind of, I know everybody here knows what we're doing, but, you know, just in case you might have got hit in the head with a softball or something, we're looking at the book of Job, and we are breaking it down right now in these sections where we have these three friends of Job. We have a guy named Bildad, and we have a guy named Zophar tonight, and then we have the other guy, I just can't think of his name. Eliphaz. Eliphaz. There we go. And what we find is we've got this character Job, and everything's been taken from him. He's lost his kids. He's lost his health. He's lost his fortune. And recall, of course, that the story of Job is one in which the first two chapters tell we, the readers, a story about the story, but the characters in the story don't know about chapters 1 and 2. And in chapters 1 and 2, we find a discussion between God and Satan about the nature of faithfulness in humankind. Satan, of course, making the argument that the reason why you like this guy, your servant Job, is so great is because he's got all this stuff. Right? If you're to take away his stuff, I promise you, Job would curse you to his face. And so God allows these things to happen. And then Job spends a period of time in mourning. He has these three friends. They come and they sit with him for a whole week and don't say a word. And then they begin to offer their advice. And we find bad advice in each one of these three so-called friends. Eliphaz, Bildad, and tonight Zophar. Tonight's title, You're So Far Away From Me. And we'll get into why Zophar's advice is wrong as well tonight. But I want to start out kind of a bigger picture. I'm going to use the word tonight, dogmatic. In case you just aren't sure, I want to go ahead and so we can understand the words that I'll probably be saying dogmatic enough. You need to know what it means. So a dogma, very simple, something that you believe is true. Right? Your dogma is your series of beliefs that you have in your heart that you'd believe to be true. If you're dogmatic, it means that you insist that what you believe is right or correct. Okay? So having dogma, not such a big deal. Everybody's got them because everybody has something that they believe in life is true. The human experience is true. When it gets tricky is when in our interpersonal relationships or sometimes even with God ourselves, we intend to try to insist that what we believe, these series of beliefs that we have, are right, true, and correct. Right? And so we have these questions being asked about what is the nature of human suffering and what is the nature of God's character with regard to fairness and justice. Again, all the way from the very first lesson on Job, we approach this concept of theodicy, to make sure I was saying that right this time, right? And a theodicy is an argument for a just God despite the existence of evil in the world. In other words, that even when bad things happen to good people, it's not a reflection of whether God's just or not. It might be a reflection of your lack of understanding with regard to why God did or did not choose to act in that particular situation. Right? So we might perceive sometimes evil in the world as unjust, but when it comes to God's justice, God's always just. This book is going to affirm this for us. And I'll say this a couple of times tonight again. Again, we have these conversations that will take place between Job and then these three friends, and then another guy will come on the scene, Elihu. He'll come on the scene a little bit later. We'll get into him a little bit later. And so we have these conversations, but God will actually show up here later. And he will address Job's questions or concerns. And what's interesting is God doesn't mind the questions that we have. God encourages us to embrace the reality of God and our lives and to wrestle with those things, to have questions. It's not the questions of ours that we have towards God. It's doubt that he hates. For many, many wearying hours I've already described, right? The three friends of Job, Eliphaz and Bildad and Zophar, all will accuse Job of all kinds of evil, right? They spoke the kind of foolish words that the healthy and ill-informed will often speak to those in pain, right? I think that's true. Sometimes I think people who everything's going right for them, and they think they've got it figured out, sometimes their advice to people who are going through struggles misses the mark because they don't have the right empathy for the pain that the person's experiencing. I also believe that it's a condition of the simple fact that, unfortunately, hurt people, right? How Job wanted to take his case to the Lord himself. He says, "Why did I not die at birth? How long will you not look away from me and let me alone till I swallow my saliva?" Job's words reflect the kind of torment that we would expect of a godly, faithful man in the midst of deep pain. But as I just mentioned, God says nothing. It's only at the end of the book that God at last breaks his silence. And whenever he answers, not one of Job's questions that Job has pondered to him, neither does he chastise Job for asking those questions. God, at the end of this story, will only rebuke Job for one thing: doubting his righteous character. The truly faithful must never be afraid to ask the hard questions of God, but neither must we demand he answer. And no matter how dark our circumstances may grow, we must resist the temptation to doubt God's holy and just nature. When we, like Job, through trembling lips of our own, confess the majesty that is God, we may at last be ready for the awesome blessings of God. Tonight, we look at Zophar, and we find that this guy, above the rest of the group, right, was extremely dogmatic, right? Again, expressing his personal opinions, personal beliefs that he has, as if they are certainly correct and cannot be doubted. Dogmatic, okay? When we read it, you'll hear it. Zophar, extremely dogmatic in his teaching and in his advice that he brings to Job. And he'll portray himself as a man who knows more about God than anybody else does, right? Whenever Zophar shows up, Zophar thinks he's arrived on the scene because he's the one that's got the special wisdom. Zophar has the special experience. It reminds me of those in our lifetime will tell us their wisdom, and then they'll tell us why we are suffering, right? And they can be this way. They can be legalist, like, you know, holding to whatever rules, sets of rules they have. They can be dogmatist with regard to their belief. And they'll say, "Now the reason why this is happening to you is because of this." And when it's dogmatic, the kind of people say, no. No, I don't want to hear your excuses. As a matter of fact, here's what's wrong in your life, and here's why you've got sin in your life. And if you are trying to insist I'm wrong, it's only more proof that I'm right. Right? And so that's the kind of character that we see here in Zophar. That even when you protest their dogmatism, all the more evidence they have to prove that they're right and you're wrong. He's a know-it-all, right? Zophar, know-it-all. You may know a know-it-all, right? But in fact, the truth is, right, just like his other friends, he does not know it all. If anything, the fact is the book of Job actually shows us that nobody can know it all. But all of these three friends, these comforters, they're also referred to, providing comfort to Job. All three of these comforters we find make the same mistakes. All three of these. Now, next week, we're actually going to bunch all three of their speeches together and Job's response in one. We've been taking these first speeches one by one. Next week, we're actually going to, now that we kind of get an idea of who each one of these guys are, we don't have to spend as much time on that. We can kind of look at their speeches together and then Job's response. So next week, we'll cover four interactions, right? Instead of just kind of the one between the one character and Job. But going into that faster movement, I want to point out something that all some things that mistakes that these all three of these guys make. The first one is that they fail to enter into Job's sorrow with him. They fail to sympathize or empathize with him. We find at one stage that Job is longing for somebody to represent it, for somebody who's touched by the same feelings of infirmities that he's had, that will not just tell him what's right and what he ought to do, but someone that will actually enter into his sorrow with him. Right? And the truth is, we all kind of feel that way when we are suffering. We all gain comfort by having people that can enter into that comfort with us so that we just have a sense that we're not suffering alone. Somebody that will, you know, shed a tear with you and not take that moment and just try to tell you what you did right or wrong. And because of what you did right or wrong, now what you've got to do. The second mistake that each one of these guys make is their conceptions of God was far too rigid, and they misunderstand how God actually works. They have this rigid conceptualization of a God that's not balanced. God, in their eyes, was too top-heavy. Now, let me explain what I mean, right? God was either a holy God and had no love in him, or was a loving God, but he's not fully holy. Right? Because these three guys, when I say that, you go, that doesn't sound right. It's not right. Right? And the reason why it's not, and the reason why these guys made the mistake, is because they believed a wrong thing about God. And because they believed a wrong thing about God, they behaved in a wrong way for God. Let me say that again. Because they believe a wrong thing about God, often it can lead us to behave in a wrong way for God. Is there such a thing as doing the right thing for the wrong reasons? You betcha. You betcha. Right? And thirdly, this word down here again, thirdly, another condition, I think, of the human experience, they're too dogmatic. Now, let's take that word out of it and let me call them something else that will make this make more sense here. They're simply too proud of themselves. Right? They're simply too proud. And so they just run roughshod over Job's feelings, all of his pains, all of his problems. Right? They don't actually listen to Job. They don't actually listen to the words that he says. And let me tell you, guys, this is one of the things I've definitely learned to do in a counseling situation. I don't mean to be any expert by any means, but I do know this, that in those situations, and you may not be counseling somebody, but you might as a friend, right, be in counsel with them. And remember that oftentimes people talk too much and listen too little. Right? Just as whoever said this, it's true. Right? There's a reason why we have two ears and one mouth. Because if we're wise, we will listen twice as much as we speak. They didn't really examine their own beliefs, right? Like I just said, they just kind of knocked Job's own personal feelings down. They don't pay any emotional attention to his pain or his problems. And what was the greatest problem of them all? Right? That they tried to answer a question that God, well, if you read the story by the end of this thing, doesn't even answer himself. They tried to answer why Job was suffering, but God doesn't answer that question. In fact, right? No one knew the reasons why. Job didn't know the reason. Nobody in the book. Again, God's Holy Spirit tells us in this divine drama, right? God's Holy Spirit tells us about this divine drama that takes place between God and Satan in chapters 1 and 2. Right? But nobody else, no other character in the story knows this. They don't know this about the story. So they call Job a hypocrite. Right? The man they call a hypocrite, God called Job an upright and holy godly man. In chapters 2 and 3, God makes it clear he had no cause or reason for afflicting Job. Because Job was not a hypocrite. Job was not a sinner. And these will be the reasons this other character that I mentioned earlier, Elihu, he's going to come in and kind of take the place of the third Zophariean speech, so to speak, I guess. He'll come in the third round there. And God's going to end up rejecting his reasoning too. And the reason why he's going to reject this is the same reason for all of these other three dudes. And that'll come in chapters 38 through 42. We're just in 12 and 14 right now, right? God just rejects all of their reason because there wasn't a specific reason you could pinpoint, right? Whether it was a sin or a justice, why God judged Job. It's just not in the text. It's left for you, the reader, the believer, to wrestle with you for yourself. Right? The fact that God doesn't answer the ultimate question that the story starts out trying to ask, why do good people suffer? God doesn't even answer that question. The author of the book didn't write the book and then go, oh no, I forgot to do the thing where I explain where God tells why they're suffering. But it's too late now because the book's already gone to the printers. Can't do anything about it. Of course not. Right? The fact that that's not in there should give you a clue as to what is important about this book. Right? And what is important about this book is there's no clear-cut answer to this question. But there can be an answer to this question for each individual person. Right? Yes. So, let's go ahead and start with our reading tonight. We're going to begin with 11. It was 12. I thought it was... Okay, 11, sorry. So, this guy character, his name is Zophar... the Naamathite. Zophar, the Naamathite. What Zophar, the Naamathite, would basically indicate to you if you were a contemporary reader is this person is not, he's probably a Gentile. So, how does that play into the story? Unfortunately, that's another section. So he says, are all of these, he's talking to Job, right? Because Job has just responded to Bildad saying, you're wrong. I haven't done anything wrong. Right? Just to catch us up. Zophar stands up and says, I can't believe this guy's going to keep saying this stuff. He says, all these words to go unanswered. Is this talker, speaking of Job, to be vindicated? Will your idle talk reduce others to silence? Will no one rebuke you when you mock? You say to God, my beliefs are flawless and I am pure in your sight. Zophar says, how I wish God could speak. That he would open up his lips against you and disclose to you the secrets of wisdom. For true wisdom has two sides. Know this, and hang on to this, we're going to come back to this. Know this, Zophar says, God has even forgotten some of your sin. Hang on to that. Can you fathom the mysteries of God? Can you probe the limits of the Almighty? They're higher than the heavens above. What can you do? They're deeper than the depths below. What can you know? Their measure is longer than the earth and wider than the sea. If he comes along and confines you to prison and convenes a court, who could oppose him? Surely he recognizes deceivers. And when he sees evil, does he not take note? But the witless can no more become wise than a wild donkey's colt can be born a human. He's, I think, kind of calling Job a jackass there. Yet if you devote your heart to him and stretch out your hand to him, if you put away the sin that is in your hand and allow no evil to dwell in your tent, then free of fault, you will lift up your face. Oh, one pages. You will stand firm and without fear. You will surely forget your trouble, recalling it only as waters gone by. Life will be brighter than noonday, and darkness will become like morning. You will be secure because there's hope. And you will look about you, and you will take rest in safety. You'll lie down with no one to make you afraid, and many will court your favor. But the eyes of the wicked will fail, and escape will elude them. Their hope will become a dying gasp. After Eliphaz and Bildad, Zophar here spoke his third offering of advice to Job. Zophar's speech begins, as I mentioned here and wrote incorrectly on the board, chapter 11, giving the strongest, I think, of this dogmatic, I know for sure I know what I'm talking about kind of speech, right? Zophar basically proclaims that Job deserves even worse than he got. In verse 6, he goes, know then that God exacts of you less than your guilt deserves. That's the word from the ESV, right? Job responds in chapter 12. He will respond in chapter 12. It was the Lord who brought this suffering upon him. And then in chapter 13, maintains his innocence by saying, I know I will be vindicated. So, looking at chapter 11, verse 6, briefly, does God forget our sins? Nothing escapes God. Right? He sees all sins. He sees all injustices in the world. Zophar, however, seems to have been sarcastically implying, right, that Job's punishment should have been and would have been much more worse if God had not forgotten all of the sin that Job had actually committed. In reality, though, God does not forget, right? Not as we understand forgetfulness. I do believe, though, that what we think of as God forgetting is God choosing to not remember our sin and mercifully wipe that slate clean. Unlike Job, Zophar had all the answers and no questions. Zophar's incorrect that asserting that if a person does all the right things, that God will in fact bless them. Right? In fact, that's what Zophar is saying here is, if you do the right things, you can compel God to act in your favor. That's the old God is a cosmic Coke machine thing, right? God, if I put my dollar bill in and I push the button, I need my Diet Coke, right? God doesn't work that way. Zophar thinks God works that way. The intellectual demands of humankind, right, become satisfied with man-made doctrine and theories because we have to acknowledge a truth that we don't necessarily like. And that is the truth that we can't force God to act. So people that fall in line with that theology, right, they become more anxious to appease a God that's become inaccessible rather than to trust in a God that actually loves them above all else. Something to think about. So let's see Job's response. So Job's response goes 12, 13, and 14. But I don't want to look at all of three chapters. So what I'm going to do is actually going to read chapters 12 and chapters 14. We're going to skip chapter 13. But know that in the beginning here at 12, Job is responding to Zophar. And when we pick up in 14, about halfway through 13, Job stops responding to Zophar and starts responding to God. So we pick up in 14, his response will be now towards God. But right now, chapter 12, Job is responding to his so-called friend Zophar. Doubtless you are the only people who matter and wisdom will die with you, but I have a mind as well as you. I'm not inferior to you. Who does not know all these things? Job says, I've become a laughingstock to my friends. though I called on God and he answered, a mere laughing stock, though righteous and blameless. Again, he's holding out his innocence. Those who are at ease have contempt for misfortune as the fate of those whose feet are slipping. He says, the tents of marauders are undisturbed, and those who provoke God are secure, those God has in his hands. Job says, but ask the animals and they'll teach you, or the birds in the sky, they'll tell you, or speak to the earth and it will teach you. Let the fish in the sea inform you. Which of all of these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this creation? In his hand is the life of every creature, the breath of all humankind. Does not the ear test words, or the tongue taste food? Is not wisdom found among the aged? Does not long life bring understanding? To God belong wisdom and power. Counsel and understanding are his. What he tears down cannot be rebuilt. Those he imprisons cannot be released. If he holds back the waters, there is drought. If he lets them loose, they devastate the land. To him belong strength and insight. Both deceived and deceiver are his. He leads rulers away, stripped, makes fools of judges. He takes off the shackles put on by kings and ties a loincloth around the waist. He leads priests away, stripped, and overthrows officials long established. He silences the lips of trusted advisors, takes away the discernment of elders. He pours contempt on nobles and disarms the mighty. He reveals the deep things of darkness and brings utter darkness into light. He makes nations great and destroys them. He enlarges nations and disperses them. He deprives the leaders of the earth of their reason. He makes them wander in a trackless waste. They grope in darkness with no light. He makes them stagger like drunkards. Job's speeches here in these three chapters are by far the longest of Job's speeches and of his friends. And in 12 through 13, 19, like I'd mentioned, he's speaking to his friends. Thereafter, 13, 20, and to the end of 14, which 14, 22, Job gives speaking to God. And Job gives a comprehensive demolition of the moralistic system that his friends have tried to portray. And the reason why he's so devastatingly correct about what they think about God and life is he shows how cruel their conceptions actually is. I mean, it's with bitter sarcasm. He laments that his friends are so wise that when they die, there might not be any wisdom left on the earth. From the comfort of their armchairs, so to speak, they mock his sufferings and insist that he couldn't possibly be innocent. For, as their successors will later say, of an innocent sufferer on a Roman cross, right? If you are under the wrath of God, you must be guilty of some terrible sin. Moralistic religion is always cruel. And never more so than to believers who suffer. Job's reply in this long speech starts with this burst of sarcasm against his counselors. He continued to speak to them through chapter 13. Beginning in 13:20, Job turns to God, creating a major break in his speech. The inclination of Job is to talk to God or to pray, right? And it's notable because it's in contrast to his counselors, his friends who give him all this great advice, who never actually say a word to God. They speak about God. They never speak to God. Job is the only one in this story ever bothers to talk to God about it. They only talk about him. Now, as we skip to 14, I want you to pay attention here. And I want you to pay attention to what Job's asking. In 14:14, Job asks, if a person dies, shall they live again? And you've come to a church, a Christian church. That's the ultimate question, right? But people just go through life thinking very, very little about eternal issues. Just living and having as good a time on earth as possible, right? Then a loved one dies. Or they go to the doctor and they learn that they have a disease that has no cure. These points in their lives, they grapple with the question, if a person dies, right? Whenever we are faced with our own mortality, we will eventually ask ourselves that question. If a person dies, will he or she live again? We see here in Scripture that in the word if, that Job was wrestling not with whether death was real, okay, but with a very chilling reality. Friends, go to the emergency room where crushed bodies lie lifeless, or the battlefields where young soldiers have been destroyed in a storm of gunfire, to rest homes where precious loved ones of ours become piles of bones and bags of pain, and ask, does a person die? Yes, of course. And death is not a very pleasant prospect. The Bible says that death is an enemy. Death is ugly. Death is unpleasant. So Job was raising the chilling prospect of death. Then he asks, shall they live again? Now, the word, again, is actually not in the original Hebrew. That's added in the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Hebrew Bible. Okay? So, the original Bible, written in Hebrew, gets all translated into Greek and becomes a book called the Septuagint. That word is in the Septuagint in the book of Job, again. Okay, and the reason why I make that distinction, one, because I think it's important to note that it's not in the original. But then the other was because it actually better defines Job wondering that if when a person dies, is that the end or does the person keep on living? See, the question's kind of the same, even if you take the word again out. It's kind of the same. If a person dies, shall that person keep on living? He is raising the appearing reality of that desire, right? God put it in each one of us. God put it in every single person, the desire to keep on living, right? I mean, you don't think about it every day, but at some point, your brain has to convince the other parts of you to keep on living today. Fight as hard as you can to continue to live. Now, there are also parts in our brain which will cause our body to do things that are contrary to that desire, but that doesn't mean the desire isn't still there. That's why we fight for life. That's why we struggle to keep on living. If a person dies, shall they live again? Or do they keep on living? This is the question that's raised by what some people call the Old Testament man of sorrows, like the righteous sufferer that we find in the New Testament with Jesus. So let's pick up his response 14 here. Chapter 1, or 14, verse 1, sorry. Mortals born of women are of few days and full of trouble. They spring up like flowers and wither away like fleeting shadows. They do not endure. Do you fix your eye on them? Will you bring them before your judgment? Who can bring what is pure from the impure? No one. A person's days are determined. You have decreed the number of their months and have set limits that they cannot exceed. So look away from them. Right? In his instance, he goes, look away from me. Leave me alone. Till he's put in his time on earth like a hired laborer. At least there's hope for a tree. If it's cut down again, it will sprout again and its new roots will not fail. Its roots may grow old in the ground and its stump die in the soil. If anybody that's tried to kill this tree over here in this vacant lot, you'll notice what it was actually the tree Job's talking about. Right? Yet at the scent of water, it will bud. and despite all obstacles, will somehow put forth shoots like a plant. But a person dies and is laid low. They breathe their last and they are no more. As the water of a lake dries up or a riverbed becomes parched and dry, so they lie down and do not rise till the heavens are no more. People will not awake or be roused from their sleep. If only you would hide me in the grave and conceal me till your anger has passed. If only you would set me a time and then remember me. If someone dies, will they live again? All the days of my hard service, I will wait for my renewal to come. You will call, and I will answer you. You will long for the creature your hands have made. Surely then, you will count my steps, but not keep track of my sin. My offenses will be sealed up in a bag. You will cover over my sin. But as a mountain erodes and crumbles, and as a rock is moved from its place, as water wears away stones and torrents wash away the soil, so you destroy a person's hope. You overpower them once for all, and they are gone. You change their countenance and send them away. If the children are honored, they do not know it. If their offspring are brought low, they do not see it. They feel but the pain of their own bodies and mourn only for themselves. Job embraced the fact of God's control over all issues of life, but challenged their meaning. Through this chapter, Job reiterates that life is short, that we are all sinners, but the days are limited, and then comes death. Right? In light of this, Job asked God for a little grace instead of such an intense judgment, little rest from the pain, suggested that maybe even a tree might have more hope than he did. In that same chapter, verses 7 through 12, Job now presses home the curse of mortality by vividly lamenting what the finality of death really is like. You cut down a tree, and it may grow again, even from the most unpromising stump, Job says. But when a human is cut down by death, that really is the end. There is no hope, or there would be no hope, right? But for a gospel message that Job can only faintly grasp, as he is about to do in the next passage. Sorry. In that next passage, 13 through 17, a dead human being is a dead human being. That's what Job has just said. Now, this is one of the most wonderful perceptions, I think, of faith. Because Job contradicts this and says, yes, amazingly, a dead human being may hope for resurrection. Job speaks one-on-one to the God that he fears and the God that he loves deeply in very personal words. All of the pronouns here are you and me and I. There will come a wonderful time, Job says, when you, God, you will call and I will answer you. Right? A glorious resurrection, a restoration, a release, where sins are sealed up and covered over. Right? Signified later in Israel's atonement, right? The covering of the Ark of the Covenant for the Jewish people and for Christians through the gospel message, our source of hope. And then finally, in the last section of chapter 14, Job laments the topsy-turvy experience of believers, just like you and me and the folks in the book of Job. Because one moment, there is assurance and hope, and the next, an overflowing wave of repeated misery on our lives. Hopefully, your life's never been that way. Unfortunately, mine has. Right? And it's the same here. After the glorious hope of the previous passage, Job laments that his present suffering attacks his hopes as the remorseless erosion of weather destroys a rock. Death and the shadow of death are terrible indeed. Jesus, as Christian believers, we would argue, Jesus finds this in his troubled soul. Same argument. We should never minimize the sadness of death or the finality that is this life. Having concluded that death is the only escape from suffering, Job suggests that God let him die and then raise him up after his anger had cooled down. The reader, however, you and me, and those original readers, already knows God's not angry with Job. Right? This chapter does not clearly teach a doctrine of resurrection, but it shows that this subject of resurrection, what happens after you die, was certainly on people's minds. Right? And the reason why I highlight that, again, I argue that the book of Job reflects as much as a theological discourse that was occurring during the time that the book was written as it was about this dude Job and how he was a really cool dude, but bad things happened to him. Right? Both are true, but to really understand as a grown-up what this book is talking about, we need to understand that there's more going on to the story than just the words in the story. Okay? So, Job's solution here at the end is just that maybe God would just go ahead and kill him. He knows God's mad at him. He thinks God's mad at him. Just let God cool off and then, whatever, I'll serve my penance. I'll do my time as long as at some point there will be restoration with you, God. And I think these conversations, as we go through what we've gone through and then what we'll continue to go through, I think a developing cycle of blame becomes evident. Right? Eliphaz, the first guy, gently accuses Job of sinning. You know, maybe he hadn't thought about it. Maybe there really is sin there that you haven't done. Bildad, right? He accuses Job of trying to pervert justice. And Zophar here tonight insensitively claims that God has probably exacted less of Job than Job probably deserved in the first place. Job, on the other hand, claims that he's done nothing wrong and is being treated unjustly by his three friends and by God, and that there is no mediator between the two of them. Here's that mediator thing that we talked about last time that seems to come up here in Job again. Right? Job's making a pretty good argument about the fact that I know you love me, and I know you care for me because you created me, but I also know how holy you are. Right? And I know that even though I think I've done nothing wrong, if I were to face you in court, my own words would still convict me against your righteousness. Does you understand what he's saying there? No matter how hard, human, no matter how hard you try, even your best defense is still guilty against God's holy nature. Right? That's a reality of it. And so, we have this problem of sin and evil in the world, but we also have an accessibility problem to God. There needs to be somebody in between. Job is actually saying, why can't somebody come and actually advocate my case for me that would have standing in the courtroom against God? Right? He's actually making that argument in this Hebrew text. Now, we Christians are going to read the book of Job, and when we get to that part, we're all going to go, aha! Right? Because we do know of a mediator. And it's not just us. It's very interesting that even the earliest Christian communities, the earliest church communities, saw the connection between Job and the Lord Jesus. So much so that it was actually common practice in the earliest parts of Christianity to read portions of the book of Job during the remembrance of the Passion Week. All right, so the week leading up to Easter and all that means with the resurrection, The early church saw this book as perfect inspiration for celebrating what they were about to celebrate. Because Jesus is the answer to Job's question. Right? I hope that you can see the reflection. Jesus is known as the man of sorrows because he takes on the sins of the world. I hope that you can see the similarities in some ways between the end of Jesus' life, particularly, whatever he takes on, sin of the world, how he bears sin in a way that Job does. Jesus, in many ways, when he fulfills his commission, he accepts the sin of the world, right? He himself has doubt. He says in that Garden of Gethsemane, if there's any other way, God, if there's any other way than my sacrifice, can we please go that option? But no matter what, despite the sin that I am taking on myself, besides, Jesus says, the sorrow I am inflicting on myself that I did not deserve, just like Job, right? Because if I'm willing to do that, I'm willing to also say, regardless of what happens to me, thy will be done, not my will. And I guess ultimately, you know, kind of here's where I think the book of Job, where we need to get comfortable as Christians with the book of Job. It gets back to this question of theodicy. You know, what does it mean to us to live in a world where, despite your best efforts and despite your most sincere faith, bad things will happen to you in your life? And when those bad things happen, it's cool. Because God's got a bigger plan for me. God's got a reason for that pain. Right? How comfortable can we get with understanding that's the reality of the faithful life? Because there are a lot of folks who do not want to accept that reality as a part of their faith. And so their life reflects it. They become just like Zophar. They stop relying on faith and relationship and God's will be done, not my will be done. And they start to put their faith not in that relationship and not in God's divine justice, but in what? Their stuff to prove their blessings. Right? It's easier that way. It's easier that way. Because then I don't have to face the prospect of the fact that I might suffer, and God could or would, but for God's reasons, he doesn't. Yeah? It's just easier to make up a whole nother story. Yeah. That's what's going on here in the story of Job. That's what the author is trying to get across to us. Right? Let's just go to the garden as we close, the Garden of Gethsemane here. I want to kind of finish with this gospel message. Go there with me for just one moment here as we close. We see Jesus there kneeling outside the city wall in Jerusalem in agony. The trees that were there that night are still there today. And they can testify perhaps to the drops of blood that fell in the garden that night. But more than that, they tell us that when the man of sorrows, Jesus, sought the comfort and the prayer of his three friends, as I mentioned earlier, they weren't able to help him either. There was none to help him, not even any to offer help. But he trod the winepress alone. He looked for someone to take pity, but there was none. He looked for his own comforters, but there were none. Surely, as believers in Christ, we examine this book of Job in which God doesn't provide the answers. But friends, we must surely see the answer to Job's questions in Jesus. Right? For all of the pain you've experienced, for all that you've gone through, here's the answer. Job's answer. Trust and hope. Though he slay me, though God might kill me, I will still trust in him. Hope. Job says, I know that my Redeemer lives. That was his hope. That was his only answer. What a joy for we Christians to know that the answer to Job has become our high priest, who's touched with the feelings of our infirmities. He's tested on all points of the human experience, just like us, and remained apart from sin, that we might have that mediator with God. And that's truly the blessing. And it's the answer to the story of Job. Next week, again, we're going to look at, we're going to have another round of these speeches. Eliphaz, Bildad, Zophar, they're going to all go again, and Job's going to respond. We're going to look at all three of those together in a little bit more of it, because we won't read the whole responses. But now that we kind of have an idea who these three characters are, we're going to kind of see what they have to say for the next round of their advice. Any questions? Awesome. If you've been following along in this series on Job, I can't help but wonder if you don't see something kind of coming to the fore that I do, that we've definitely seen over the last couple of episodes, and that is this understanding that Job has about the need for a redeemer, somebody to step in between a holy God and a flawed human existence. Now, I want to say right away, even though I'm just a semi-seminarian, I know enough that the purpose of the book of Job, the intent of the writers, had nothing at that time to do with the person that we know as Jesus of Nazareth. And I am not trying to say that. I am, though, from the Christian tradition, trying to at least maybe highlight the possibility that maybe God, not answering the question in the Hebrew scriptures in Job, answers the questions, that question in the New Testament. That God does actually provide that redeemer, that mediator that we need between the two. Somebody who can argue our life from our point of view and yet have standing in the court. Again, as Christians, I can't help but see the character of Jesus of Nazareth as the fulfillment of that necessary mediator. I wonder what you think. Leave me a comment. Let me know. Hey, listen, also, if you would please, if you'd like this episode, if you'd please subscribe to the podcast, if you'd leave us a review wherever you listen to us, on Spotify, on Apple iTunes, iHeart, however you're listening to us, if you'd somehow at least just let us know that you're listening, it would give us all the encouragement of the world to keep going if you like what we do. Until then, friends, next time I hope you will be just as excited as I am. And until then, be blessed.